super excited to be chatting with Ronnie Higgins, formerly of Eventbrite, Udemy, Hopin, and now Open Phone, one of the best content minds in the industry. A hidden gem. And I know that that's rarely talked about as folks that are kind of doing their thing, but you're a hidden gem in the space. You do exactly what you're supposed to do as content marketers, which is try to create content that pushes your audiences forward, but ultimately push culture forward by creating things that are a little bit different. And you've done this time and time again. We'll dive into a bit of it over the course of this chat, but super excited to dive in and have a conversation with you today. So thank you for making the time. Before we get into it, as you mentioned, side projects, it's something that you've embraced, which I love. Marketing under the influence is something that you've been investing a lot of your time and energy into. I was reading one of the pieces and you said, my attempt might fail, this might suck, and that's okay, because what matters most to me right now is knowing that I tried. As you work alongside plenty of other projects, like, how do you navigate failure, and what are some of the things that you've experienced through the ups and downs of that type of a feeling with things like marketing under the influence and other projects that you've been a part of?
I love starting with this question. By the way, thank you so much for having me here. You know, I am a huge fan of you.
Appreciate it.
I think we started to like build a relationship off of the fact that I saw create content that shapes culture and said, hey, yeah, I want to talk to you about this, because
yeah,
it's been just how I've always thought about it. Because what I'm actually trying to do with marketing under the influence is the culmination of what I have failed to do over the last few years, which is explore the frontier of B2B marketing while in-house. Mm. And it started at Eventbrite, and then I had no delusions that it would ever happen at Udemy. And then at Hopin, had carte blanche to sort of do it, but had been focused for the first year on building the revenue engine and then got laid off. So I had like this, the rug pulled out of me, like from right, under me, like multiple times,
right,
trying to do this thing. And that thing is applying concepts from outside of B2B content marketing, things from broadcasting, things from beyond publishing even. And so with marketing under the influence, it is me finally scratching an itch that I've been trying to scratch for years. And the reason that I say what I said in that piece is that I was very scared to do it on my own. I always felt right, like it was better to do it in-house.
Right.
And this idea to do it on my own while I'm working a full-time job and I'm the steward of a brand's organic marketing strategy while being the parent of a toddler, like, scared me. And I was like, you know, I'm never going to feel satisfied that, you know, because I keep talking about it, of
right,
why I believe that, like, people who are talking about building a media company don't know what they're talking about, or they're confusing quality or polished content for a media company. And there's just so much more to it than that. And
right,
so I'm embracing failure to allow myself to finally just get this off my chest in a way.
Right.
Because like
right,
marketing under the right, influence is an idea I've been sitting on for a couple of years now.
Right. Right. Tell me a little bit more around what you just said there, is that like folks are making the mistake of not really understanding what a media company looks like. Like, let's get into that a little. And I know it's off of the, it's not necessarily in our list of questions, but
I'm going
to do this over the course of today. What does that mean to you? Like, what do you mean when you say, they keep saying it, but they don't really get it?
It's, we've conflated the idea of a media company. It's become a buzzword, the way content is king became a buzzword. And then there's the contrary, you know, content isn't king, context or distribution,
right,
and
right,
all that. Like, yeah. And so there's people who are even hating on the idea of building a media company that feel like, you know,
right,
they're like, oh, was that just a 0% interest, you know,
right,
phenomenon? And I don't believe it is. I truly believe that it is the next like evolution of what we consider content marketing, particularly in B2B. It is this idea that basically we are moving from blogs and ebooks, and we're all of that is saturated today. Like at Hopin, if I were to ever release the strategy, the very beginning of it says that there's like millions of results for a hybrid event guide. And I'm like, how do you differentiate yourself when everybody's doing the exact same thing, using the exact same playbook? And this goes back to like just strict, you know, basic business school tactics of that's a red ocean strategy. You now need to see, is there a blue ocean strategy that I can take advantage of? And that blue ocean strategy is understanding the mediums and not just going and applying what we've been doing the last decade in content marketing to podcasts and events, but understanding that there's different formats and different interests. So let me actually explain. Marketing Under the Influence is by virtue a show for marketers because it's all about marketing. But the content of Marketing Under the Influence isn't about day-to-day. Marketers aren't on Marketing Under the Influence talking about their jobs. They're not saying, here's this campaign I ran or this content I wrote. They're talking about the media that influenced them. The first episode is about Annette is focused on Annette Cardwell, who is the VP of brand and comms at Lattice. And instead of talking about, you know, shit she does for Lattice, it's focused on the moment that she went from a token Asian kid in rural Virginia who's was poor and had little access to media, was struggling to belong because she everybody around her was either black or white and everybody treated her differently. And she was like, I don't have a way to like fit in. And she one day at a summer camp sees a Star Wars movie and she sees 300 kids go from being complete strangers to best friends. And it's in that moment she realizes, oh, media can connect me to other people. It can, they create shared experiences and shared interests. And it's like it unlocked like something in our life. And so each episode ends with me sort of reflecting on what it means for marketers or what it means to me as a marketer. And so that episode helps me understand that when we write an ebook or if we do a podcast like this, it's not just about, oh, check, we did a podcast. It's no, like thinking even just for a second about what role this piece of content may play in someone's life beyond that. Like what impact does it make? How does it shape culture? How does it reach someone? And those are the things that when, if you work for a real media company, especially a multimedia or omni-channel company like Disney or a television network, when they are trying to choose content, they don't just go, all right, so we need to target, we need a show that targets stay-at-home moms. They don't think, okay, we just need a talk show with stay-at-home moms. They do the research to figure out what are all the various like shared interests and shared experiences that we can emulate in a piece of media, whether it is a piece of fiction, nonfiction, documentary, game show. Does not matter. It's about how do I like cultivate an audience and how do I like bring them together as like a community so I can then sell them something. And in the traditional media, that sell them something is an ad that has no bearing on it, but on like the content or no relationship really. But if you are, say, a B2B brand and you're the one providing that entertainment or say even just edutainment, then that's your opportunity. Instead of selling ads, you are the ads and gives you a chance to let people know that, like, you know, this show has been brought to you by OpenPhone, who does this thing. And there's that, and no one is doing that. No one is like doing the research. Like every B2B like podcast, like I hesitate to say it, but like every show seems to be the same thing, which I call faces and names. The idea is that the, like, I think your show and like a handful of shows that do this Q&A format, are focused on the content, but there's too many of them that do a checkbox on it's about the name. It's right. more about the celebrity of the professional being the lead magnet more than the content itself.
Right. And if you were talking to someone who hears you right now, if they hear this, they're like, whoa, names and that just like names and faces, that's all we're doing. We need to shake it up. What would be your advice to them to kind of get out of that current state in B2B with podcasts or webinars where they're just like on that hamster wheel of embracing interviews?
I'll tell you how I'm doing it this year at cool. Open Phone. So you hear everybody on Twitter, now X, LinkedIn, yep. talk to your customers.
Right.
Well, tomorrow I have a kickoff meeting with a research firm and my team to develop the interview strategy to do a qualitative analysis, like sort of survey,
cool.
interview survey of our customers. And we're going to, the part I won't tell you about is like the very details, but I'll be asking them about their opinions and right. their understanding and their like, competency levels related cool. to the topics that we want to own.
Yeah.
And then that's the bulk of the interview. And then the other carving off a quarter of that interview for understanding their media consumption habits. And that goes beyond just, it's like, where do you tend to find information? Like how does right. information, valuable information come to you?
Right.
And then when you do come in contact with valuable information, what do you do with it?
Right.
Because we want to understand the social value of content as well. The way media companies think about this is you could probably find an article to send you that you can add to the show notes, but it talks about cool. how like NBC and all these networks are thinking about how fans interact with the like shows and the media online and how they then create like events that spin off of things, you know?
Right.
And that's where I think you need to go is it's a mindset. That's why it's been so hard to like sort of like lead this crusade, because unlike the playbook from HubSpot back in the day, it's not a step-by-step process that any B2B SaaS company can follow.
Right.
Although there's some element of truth to that, but it's more of a mindset that you need to have before anything. And then you can apply it. Even if you have just a blog, you can apply that mindset. You don't have to have a podcast or a webinar or anything. It's like caring about how someone like interacts with your content and the consumption experience. It essentially boils down to what John Bonini calls the content brands, and which I think he's now starting to say is the outcome of treating content as a product. A lot of people have pushed back against that idea, saying, "No, the product is the product." And I'm like, it's okay for the product to be the product and for content to be the product at the same time, because your content has a customer and you need to convert that customer.
Yep. That makes complete sense. It is interesting. Like people get upset over this idea of content being viewed as a product, but at the end of the day, if you provide that much utility to someone, it can be in very clearly considered a product.
Exactly. I mean, like, I think early in my career, this is like back when there wasn't a lot of content about content.
Right.
Definitely not as much as there is today. But like, there wasn't a clear delineation at the time between UX content strategy and content marketing. So when I came across like Christina Halverson, Rebecca Lovinger, and all these like other UX content professionals who had made a name for themselves, I absorbed all that stuff, and it made me realize like it's about the consumption experience, which is essentially user experience.
Right.
So like when someone's like reading the content, you stuffed all the keywords and you got all the like an A+ on ClearScope, but if someone is gonna like read it and have no and feel just pain reading it, you've not done your job.
Right. Yeah. No, 100%. That makes complete sense. Let's go back into time a little bit, because I think your history from the early days to now is fascinating, and it all connects. So can you take people back through your journey a little bit into the early days of your career, your background, and that transition into the wonderful world of B2B content?
For sure. So it was the year 2008, and I was working in film and television in New York City when the economy and sort of came crumbling down, and all these jobs I had lined up started to dry up. I got phone calls saying they were canceling that production, or they had to give my role to someone in the union, which I wasn't in. Right. And so I found myself either needing to go back home to New Orleans or coming back to San Francisco, where I spent a year after Hurricane Katrina. And I chose the latter. And when I took a desk job, I asked them, hey, you know, I know how to make videos. Do you want me to make a video about this new project that y'all are doing? They're like, sure, whatever. Just don't let it interrupt your work. And so I had a camera and everything. I made a video. And all of a sudden, when I got done with the video, the CMO and the CEO were like, hey, can you keep doing that?
Right.
So I became a video marketing video producer. Cool. And then that led me to either deciding, I thought about going into advertising, but then it was too cutthroat for me. And I was just too old at the time. I was even in my 30s and thought I just couldn't go through the ringer there. And then I stumbled upon Joe Paluzzi's Get Content, Get Customers. And I just was introduced to the idea of content marketing. And as soon as I devoured that book, I brought it to the CMO and said, this is what I want to do.
Right.
And it didn't happen overnight, but very slowly, like, got the title of content marketing manager, then ended up sort of knowing all the best practices we all know today back then, but I couldn't apply them because I was the only one who gave a shit about content marketing. So I started looking for, sorry, I don't know if I'm supposed to curse or not.
It's all good. It's all good.
but I basically started looking for jobs, and that was when I got the job at Eventbrite, and I got to work for one of the people who taught me how to do content marketing via her ebooks, Margaret Jones.
Right.
And so from there at Eventbrite, worked everything that you know today and we all talk about today in content marketing, from repurposing to distribution to we had quality rubrics back then that we had, like, I feel like if I still had access to all the stuff we had, it'd blow people's minds that we were doing what half of the people, not even half of content marketers are doing today, like 5-6 years ago.
Right.
And that's cool. How I got into content marketing.
Love it. Love it. Love it. That's amazing. It's interesting because you come from the wonderful world of like TV and movies, et cetera. And when you think about media and assets, for me personally, anyways, I think that world has had some of the most influential stories that have impacted culture. And you and I both align on this idea where we talk about creating content that shapes culture. Do you think it connects and stems from that in those early days? Like, do you think there's a connection between those early lessons and you've brought it with you to the wonderful world of B2B?
I mean, if I needed to tell the really long story, it actually goes all the way back to being a little kid. When I was a little kid, I was obsessed with like entertaining and the Beach Boys and movies. And, you know, my parents would have their friends over to play cards and stuff on a Friday night. And I'd make them watch me put on like a lip sync show in like the living room. And then in high school, I helped run our TV studio at a magnet school, and made videos on the weekends with my friends. It's been part of me. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans where like storytelling and music is just like so prevalent. And so it comes from there, but I think, yes, it does. A lot of my time, like my training, because I also have a film degree.
Right.
So my training, I worked in broadcast and television. Like so much of that, I think, is why I approach content the way I do, because earlier I talked about content consumption. That's something as a filmmaker or anybody who's doing like motion picture television thinks about. There's so much structure. There's so much like thought of like, and this is probably another reason that I have a gripe with the whole media company thing is they think like, oh, I had a red camera. or right. something right. fancy. And it's like, dude, you could have just used your iPhone. And if, True. But if you knew the vision, like, here's my like kind of pithy take that could be the whole clip you post to LinkedIn is like, is I find it deeply ironic that for years, the people who would post about, you know, using the correct punctuation and grammar rules, like the grammar Nazis right, who have now right. jumped into podcasting and video are completely oblivious to the fact that visual and audio like formats have their own grammar.
Right. Right.
Like if there's ways that you set up a shot that actually tells us psychologically what's happening, it's they true. Help, they make us feel something. And so I think right. when I look back at like, did film influence me as a content marketer? The answer is hell yes, because right. I think about, all right, someone had to pass four search engine marketing ads
yep.
to find my result and saw my title and summary amongst 10 plus more. How does mine stand out? Then, all right, they've clicked on it. What's mm-hmm. the way I can make sure that I feel like they don't feel buyer's remorse for clicking? So I think right. about like that feeling and the emotion throughout. And the way I do this with my team is I have in our briefs, we don't say like, what's the thesis of this piece, but I force every producer and writer to think about what is the begin state? Where is their head when they find this piece of content? And then what's the end state? Because right. back to, you know, I treat the customer or the audience, the person consuming the content, like a protagonist. They right. have to go through a transition. And the reason for needing to go through a transition, even if it's a SEO listicle, they have to be a different person by the end, because then that is what creates the emotional connection to the brand and the content that makes them keep coming back.
I love that. I love that. It's refreshing to hear, because a lot of people are just like, let's produce. Let's move on to the next one. Let's do some keyword research. Let's create a thing that's set up to rank. And that's kind of it. When you're thinking about your strategies and your plans, like, I know one of the things that is admirable about your approach is like, you've thrown out the old playbook of 2010 and said, okay, how do we do this differently in today's economy, in today's market with multi-channels and different channels where people trust people? How do you plan your strategies for a year?
Yeah. You know, I will say the people who do follow the 2010 playbook, I may... Right. come across as though like I think you're the worst person in the world or something like that. But I want to make it clear that like marketing is really, really hard, right? Especially right now. And there right now, like, it's not easy no matter what your profession is, and people are just trying to survive.
Right.
And if there are lots of people out there that do care, do want to do a good job, but they're stretched too thin to be able to do anything beyond that.
Right.
And so I want to make sure that I say that, but I do want to say, like, if you want to break free, the way I approach initiatives every year is first is resources.
Yep.
So if I'm like right now, we're recording this beginning of January, Open Phone's on a fiscal year. So recently, right before the break, we were talking about fiscal year 25 planning, which right. begins in February. And I started that conversation off with like, do I have the same team? Do I have the same budget? What is it like? And from there, like, I know, okay, well, I could potentially grow the team, or I could potentially grow the budget if I can justify it. And then right. what that then leads me to is knowing, like, all right, what do I have in terms of capacity, so I can do a stretch goal versus a, like, because all my strategies have something that's missing in a lot of content strategies, which is a risk assessment of like, it's that says like everything that I just told you about is dependent on, and then a bullet list of things that have to happen, right. Like budget and all that. And then what I do then is so product is always like a moving target, but we spend a lot of time just talking about what are the maybes, just see like the product roadmap over the next year. So we could see, make sure that the narrative aligns.
Right.
And then from there, it's about gathering inputs from across the business. So sales, CS, not just product, but even just engineering, letting anybody who from leadership around, like, it's their opportunity to say, like, you know, if we supported you in any way, like at Hopin, like I had to do this because there were so many other departments. I'd be like, what events are you going to plan?
Right.
Because I didn't want them. We weren't a service org. And I hate when content is a service org where it's like, hey, I need a deck for a presentation. Right. It's like, in fact, our team channel on Slack is two birds, one scone, because of the saying feed two birds with one scone, which which I'm kind of a pacifist, or like I'm not like one of those like total hippies who's vegan or anything like that, but I just also didn't want to have to like keep saying to kill two birds with one
scone. Right. I love it. That's amazing. I never heard it before, but I'm stealing it. I like it.
So feed two birds with one scone is like they give me those inputs so I can then say, all right, well, right, we want to do an SEO piece on this, and if we do it at this week, then it'll be able to be repurposed into something 2 weeks from then for someone else. And so there's a lot of like organization of the like cross-functional needs.
Cool.
And then from there, it's like keyword research that goes beyond just like SEO tools. We look at like what's the social value of the topics that we're going after. And then right now we're undergoing a project where we are auditing and building out the clusters. So earlier I told you about the qualitative research that we're going to be doing with customers.
Right.
We have a list of like broad topics that we want to be known for.
Right.
And what we've done is like, so the research is going to figure out what people's like, you know, take a pulse on what they know and what they feel and think about those topics. And then what our SEO team has done is built out the clusters of those and how they then leave a breadcrumb trail to our product feature benefits.
I love it.
So like we'll have like, you can imagine as a visual as like each product feature benefit is a node that branches off into another node that is the broad topic that then has branches for the keywords.
Mm, I love that.
And so that's how we approach the initiatives for the year. We're looking at what we have, what we need, and it's all about building topic authority and less about just ranking in SERPs.
Right. I dig that.
Although that's important.
It's so important. I want to have some fun. I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball here. So one of my favorite posts from you, and I think we went back and forth both on LinkedIn and maybe even on X about it, was how both of us have the dream of someday being able to get the like paid marketing budget for our budget as content teams and what we would be able to create. So I want to, this is completely off the cuff. Let's pretend for a second that you are a startup that is going into the wonderful world. Let's say I want to do something that's not familiar. You're going to compete with Google Sheets. So we're going after Google Sheets. There's a software product that we're just about to build. We've got a ridiculous budget, paid marketing budget, any scope that we want, we can do. Anyone you want to reach, you can reach. How do you approach your marketing efforts if you are trying to compete with Google Docs and you have an unlimited paid budget that is now applied to content? What would you do with it?
Oh, I'm loving this, but I'm also hating you for it. No. It's funny because like I remember thinking about that and I was like, man, like in film school, I would have killed for like $10,000 to like make a movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's some PPC budgets that are like in the mil per month. It's
true.
Ridiculous.
Multi-mills. Yeah.
And I think it's not like I think like 100% organic strategy is like that. I'm no delusions that you need paid.
Yeah, 100%. But
if I had that budget, the first thing I would do is I mean, this would have been easier if I knew like the audience more so than the product. So like, let's just say it's we find out it's specifically a spreadsheet for, I don't know, interior designers.
Perfect. Let's say that. I mean, yeah, let's go with that. Interior designers. I dig it.
I'm looking at the bare walls that I'm like, oh, you should put around here. But if it's for interior designers, like from there, I start to understand, all right, beyond their day-to-day jobs, like what is it that they enjoy? Like what other content do they consume beyond like how to's or anything like that? Because an interior designer is not looking up how to do a, you know what I'm trying to think of, what a freaking interior designer wouldn't search for.
They're not going to search for what is interior design. Lots of search volume, like, but they're probably not looking up what is interior design, which in a lot of content strategies rooted in keyword research, we probably say that's the first thing you have to do. You have to create a piece that says, what is interior design?
And so like the problem that the short-sightedness of that is that an interior designer, if they saw that article, they wouldn't search for it. But if they saw it, they'd be like, okay, I'm going to read this. And then if it's written by someone who just like regurgitated like a Wikipedia article, like, they would lose credibility. Right. But, all right. So what would I do with that budget is I'd probably figure out a sort of either a game show, kind of like Top Chef of interior design, like challenges.
Right.
Or I would do something like the, you know, I don't know what channel it comes on because I don't have cable, but like those shows where like it's like the opposite. I used to watch a lot of Food Network, so a lot of my ideas come from Food Network. But like, you know, the restaurant Hell's Kitchen, like the Gordon Ramsay, like where you go in and be like, your like restaurant is
that's
shit.
Cool. That's
like
cool.
Having like interior designers like in different regions be able to defend their choices of how they're gonna like, you know, do a makeover of someone's house.
That's
and
cool.
So instead of it just being, because most shows would that are currently exist already are like, we're gonna like hire an interior designer to, you know, fulfill your dream. Well,
right,
instead of that being the premise is actually we are going to follow an interior designer who's going to do a dream, and someone who is like a world-renowned interior designer is going to like do the Gordon Ramsay thing of demolishing That's their ego.
Yeah,
and 100%. Then so it's things like that. Like I think of like what's it going to take? Because I the thing right now that everybody needs is that the gig is up on.
True.
People understanding content marketing. Our customers understand what we're doing. It used to be like, oh, they stumbled upon a what is interior design article and fell in love with you. But nowadays there's a billion what is interior design articles and everybody kind of just goes, eh. So you need to think of like, if that's not going to help you stay in earn mind share and attention, then you need to do something different. And so if I had a paid budget, I would do a limited run series of that one of those shows, say 20 episodes, and that would pay for the talent and that would pay for production. And I'd even have money left over for distribution because it needs to get distributed.
I love it. I love it. That's a great playbook. And the thing that I think stands out to me is like, it's easy to get the reference to the product subtly. Like a lot of people go in for the kill immediately where it's like, let's blast our product all over this piece. Let's make it everywhere. But with that angle where you're focused on entertaining, educating, and like really engaging your community, you're just adding value to it. And you can subtly reference the product, which is cool. I love it. Awesome. Let's go back to the traditional style of these things. I do love that idea and I'd love to brainstorm more. But I want to get into some tactical advice for folks. A lot of folks listening to this are going to look at your career and they're going to say, I want that. I want to go down a path similar to Ronnie. I'm early in my career, but what do I need to do to get there? What would be your advice to some folks who are trying to make it through the content world, specifically in B2B, and they want to eventually get to a point where they're the director of content at some of the most ambitious and successful brands of all time?
Oh man. First, I would question why they would want to be me, because they want to be them, but and have some version of my quote unquote success.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%.
I would say they definitely should read, instead of reading like there's great teachers out there. Like, you on Foundation do a really good job of sharing knowledge. There are people like you, Devin Reed, is like a handful, like Amanda Natividad when she does her content, 201. There's a lot of really great teachers, and I say focus on them to just understand the content marketing we've all come to know. Mm. But I would then tell them that they need to spend the rest of their time studying other forms of content, or other forms of media. There's a book called a book that Jay Akunzo recommended to me years ago called Out on the Wire. If you're going to do podcasting, that book is like a comic book or graphic novel that is basically this woman followed around all the producers and journalists of like This American Life, Radiolab, Moth, Planet Money, all these. And it wasn't just like, okay, what mic do you use? Or do you have a template email that you send to people? It was more about like, it's more about like their decision-making and how they approach their craft.
Right.
So like absorbing things like that, learning how, movie studios, there's this really good piece. I'll send you a link that you can add to the show notes too, about like the, how A24, the movie studio, got to where it is today. Cool. Which I think holds the secret of how to build a media company in this new era, which I guess I could share more about. But, learning how other people do it, subscribing to non-B2B marketing or just marketing in general, newsletters and YouTube series and podcasts. And it's kind of like this, when Margaret Jones at Eventbrite was basically mentoring me to be the content marketer I was today. She encouraged me to read more. At the time, I was kind of reading leisurely. And she's like, well, if you read like something and then you stop reading and immediately start writing, see what happens. And there's this piece of content that I swear, if somebody listening from Eventbrite can find it on the hard drives there, please. But I can't remember the name of it either. I had this piece of content that was about event data that just bombed. Turns out at the time, event organizers just didn't care. They were like event planners. They didn't care about data.
Right.
Data wasn't a big thing yet. And so when Margaret gave me that advice, I was reading Patrick Lencioni's Death by Meeting, which if you haven't read any of his books are not how-tos or typical business books. 3/4 of it are usually a business fable, with the last quarter of it being the playbook or instructions for doing things. Mm. And so I took this approach of a business fable of someone taking on an event, an established event, and applying data to it. And that thing blew up.
Cool.
And so like, it's just about like absorbing things from outside of B2B marketing, and stepping outside of the marketing echo chamber is how you get to where I am.
Right. Yeah, no, I love it. I think one of the biggest issues that people have is they do go down the path of obsession around seeing their career grow, and all they do is focus on people who are in their career path. Like, they don't go outside and consume other pieces of content. They don't understand other niches, under other sectors, all of that stuff. So giving people the guidance to say like, all right, don't be afraid to step back and immerse yourself into other areas is great advice. I 100% agree. A question for you again, when it comes to outside of work, like, what else are you spending time thinking about and working on, and like where else do you spend your time?
So recently for Marketing Under the Influence, I had a choice of either hiring an engineer to make sure that my podcast sounded good,
right,
or hiring a production coordinator to help me like grow this, because Marketing Under the Influence is the first project of many I have lined up. Cool. And so Marketing Under the Influence is going to be like a springboard to something else that'll be out around May and a few other projects throughout the year. Cool. And so working, I recently spent some time learning how to, you know, make sure audio sounds really good. Cause even though I went to film school, I kind of glossed over the audio parts cause I didn't right. care that much. I was more interested in like understanding the visual stuff and, producing and directing actors and screenwriting. But recently had to teach myself a lot of that stuff, which if you listen to the podcast, let me know if there's anything I need to do better and I can learn.
For sure.
I read a lot of fiction. I read a lot of non-marketing newsletters. I like absorbing stuff about science and history and all these things, because you end up, it's kind of something I learned also at Eventbrite, was the chief strategy officer, he was also chief financial officer at a time, Randy Mifumo, would sometimes entertain little one-on-one sessions with me, and I was asking him about my media strategy back in 2019.
Right.
And he used like Napoleon's battles to help me understand why my strategy wasn't going to work.
Right.
And kind of like helped me understand that there's transferable knowledge like everywhere. And that's so cool. I spend more time reading things and absorbing things that are not related to my job, so that I can like give my brain that break, but also give it opportunities to see ideas that I might not have found elsewhere.
Tell me a bit about Neutral Ground Network.
So Neutral Ground Network is the like foundation on which I'm going, like building everything on. I originally started to lead with Neutral Ground Network and realized that that was just too confusing for people. So I'm currently focused on Marketing Under the Influence, which will evolve into Neutral Ground Network. And
cool.
Neutral Ground Network is, first I'll explain the name.
Yeah.
So I'm from New Orleans, grew up there, didn't leave until like my mid-20s. And in New Orleans, the neutral ground is the colloquial term for the grassy median of a street.
Cool.
And it's called the neutral ground because in like 18-something, when the French, right after the French had sold the Louisiana Purchase to the United States, there was still a bunch of French people in the French Quarter and Americans and stuff that had moved into the surrounding neighborhoods. And there was this like sort of like transgression between the groups that would disappear when they would step into the median to conduct business.
Right.
And over time, this neutral grounds name stuck. And then over the years growing up, to many people like me who grew up in New Orleans, the neutral ground is a meeting place. Like
cool.
It's a place, there's like basketball courts on them. There are like places where people go and hold a protest or a right. rally.
Right.
And on Mardi Gras Day, it's the best seat in the house.
Right.
You set up a chair and catch some beads and drink some beer or something.
Love it.
And so I wanted Neutral Ground to be a place, a Neutral Ground Network to be a place where I, first off, get to go back to my roots and where I get to test and explore the like frontier of B2B marketing with my own risk assessment.
Right.
So, like I said, Marketing Under the Influence.
That's cool.
It doesn't have specific like lessons about marketing. I trust that marketers are smart enough to glean their, you know,
right.
glean the like lessons from the abstract.
Yeah.
But like there's one of the next projects potentially that I'm developing is something for Mental Health Awareness Month in May.
Cool.
Because there's marketers who have like mental health awareness issues that I want to like give us a place to like talk about those and normalize them a little bit. There's another project that's in development where right now we are at a crossroads where, and Rand Fishkin talks about this, where we're kind of going back to basics before digital marketing.
Right.
And so one of the projects that is in development right now is a series that will interview people from back then before digital marketing to understand how did they come up with their ideas? How did they implement them? How did they measure them?
Right.
Like all those things that will become prevalent and useful today. I think about there's essays with Marketing Under the Influence where I sort of am sharing my perspectives on things, teaching people those concepts from across media.
Right.
There's a series that that sort of branches off from it called, it's Teachers, Texts, and the idea there is I will like highlight a text that has like influenced me. And one of the pieces that I've done recently, and sorry for cursing again, is a academic essay called On Bullshit, which a Princeton professor did a extensive research on the etymology and usage of the word to understand it. And instead of me like kind of breaking down the academic paper just to break it down, I break it down as what it means to me as a marketer and how it helped me understand why people share content. So like, let's imagine someone listens to this episode, right?
Yeah.
When they go to share and say, you need to listen to Ronnie's episode of Ross, what is it that they're going to say to that person as to why?
Right.
And
right.
So when you read a paper like On Bullshit, or you read Bill Gates's 1996 essay on Content is King, which is where the phrase
came from. Yeah.
What didn't originate there, but it's where the popularity of it came from.
Right.
You start to like understand our like world a little bit better too, or content marketing and B2B marketing and media. And so I think of just all those things as like part of Neutral Ground, and I'm inviting like those other projects I'm talking about of interviewing other people and the mental health are with other marketers. So the reason I call it Neutral Ground Network and Neutral Ground Neighborhood when I eventually launch it as a community is it's a gathering place for the marketers who just need to unleash something that they can't unleash elsewhere.
Right.
And so if Marketing Under the Influence is that for me, Off the Clock with Kaylee Moore, Krista Doyle, and Ali Decker, like that's for them. Like,
right.
I helped them sort of launch that, but I'm not really involved with it. But it's this idea of like, we have these talents and we want to use them for ourselves. And I'm creating a place for us to do them.
I love it. That's amazing. Very cool. When you think of all of these different projects and you think of the fact that you've also got a 9-to-5, you got a little one, you've got all of this stuff going on, what is your like approach to managing all of these things? Like, is there any insight that we can get into like how you manage and juggle all this?
Well, one of the things is I'm definitely not a solopreneur. I'm paying someone as a production coordinator on the side to help me out.
Right.
And you know, I don't have a sponsor, but once I have like more episodes out, we'll maybe find some bandwidth to do that. But which will help me finance it. Cause like Marketing Under the Influence was the podcast was originally conceived as a animated series, but
interesting.
Yeah, because the stories are not about the person as they are today. And I thought it'd be distracting to look at a video of a person today telling a story about back then. And I thought each episode is like 10, 15 minutes long. They're not long. And so like an animation of that person's story would be visually appealing and interesting to watch. But like if I get to that, have money to do that, sure, but I also didn't have bandwidth, so I had to like as we call in writing, killing our darlings. And so I had to scale that back. I had to like there's like I'm proud of the show and I'm proud of the like quality of what I'm putting out there and how it's hopefully going to shape culture.
Right.
But I'm also realizing like I'm only one person and I can only do so much. So like there are ways I'm like cutting corners that I wish I wasn't.
Fair.
But fair. So just being able, that's where the failure thing comes in, is like it's progress over perfection. And right. So it's fitting things in when I have, like when my daughter's two right now, so when she's taking her midday nap or after she's gone to bed doing some work until I go to bed. So I fit it in there because family comes first, obviously, and then obviously the day-to-day job, because I believe open phone is my number one responsibility in terms of my professional life. But I am also building this because I'm sick of waiting for someone else to prove it.
I love it. I love it. All right. We're going to wrap this with two simple Mad Lib questions. All right. The first one is, before I became a content marketer, I wish I would have known that blank.
Honestly, I wish I would have already known enough about publishing and where the like best practices and concepts of content marketing came from. I had to learn all of that from scratch. And most of the content marketers that exist today came from journalism school or from journalism or, you know, wrote a book or a novel when they were like 8 years old.
Right.
And I knew marketing because I used to throw raves and nightclub events and promoting things. So like I knew marketing, all the like lingo and the three letter acronyms and crap, like all kind of slowly came to me. But the hardest part was learning the like publishing stuff. It really was like the source of my imposter syndrome, because everything I had known was about how to make a movie or a TV show or video. I didn't know anything about like publishing a ebook. And I just wish I would have known that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. In order to be a content marketer, you have learned that the single most important skill to develop is what?
You know, it's not related to actually producing content. I feel like that's like the easiest stuff to learn. The most important thing I think I've learned is emotional intelligence.
Right.
We talk about office politics, even in a remote setting, and the term like kind of denotes like people being passive aggressive or stabbing each other in the back. But in business, it's similar to like international relations and stuff where there's like diplomacy. Right. And so when I think of office politics today, I think of how do I like make everyone not just believe what I want them to believe, but how do I like get consensus? How do I get people to, you know, think of me in a certain way? And that's then bled into not just like my internal day-to-day job, but then my networking. It's how I've grown my network, and having that sort of emotional intelligence to be able to show up and be present and be engaging and empathetic is probably key to everything. It helps you in interviews. It helps you manage people. It helps you grow your network. I think it's the gift that keeps giving is all I can say.
I love it. That's amazing. I 100% agree. Folks, if you want more of Ronnie, check him out at Marketing Under the Influence. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and keep an eye out. You can also follow him on all of the various social channels, Ronnie Higgins, typically. Just give him a follow. Ronnie, is there anywhere else that I missed that folks should visit and check you out?
That's it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate the friendship and the connection over the years, and looking forward to staying in touch and continuing to root for you and all of your great work. So I appreciate you.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you.